All right. We've got about three things to look at today, quickly, and then we're done. So next class, Thursday, basically, if you're interested, you can come and we can have a debugging kind of thing where if you've got a problem that you're having, you can get up here and put up your problem and have the class debug it. I've done that before, and that seems to work out fairly well. Next week is all open labs. So Monday is 11 to whenever, definitely 2. And basically, the way I will stay till 4 on all of those days if somebody's here. But if nobody's around, then I've got better things to do. So I'm going to leave. Okay, so Monday is 11 to 2. If people are here, I'll stay till 4. Tuesday is 9:30 to 2 or 4. And Thursday's 9:30 to 2 or 4. Okay, so those are open lab times for, you can come to any of the times for all my classes. And so that's where we stand. Homework assignments are due on the last day of classes, which is November 14th. I begrudgingly take a couple of things after that, up until your final, but I'm not nice when I correct them. You better not have any errors in them, because it's minus 50 for every error I find kind of thing. Not really, but I will say nasty things about you if you pass in too much. After the 14th. Because I've got to get ready for the holidays too, and all my family is coming to my house this year, so somewhere in there.
You do realize on the 13th you just set yourself up to, right?
What?
You do realize on the 13th you just set yourself up.
Why?
Because everybody's going to flood the email on 13th and
14th. 14th. Oh, I do know that, yes. Yes. All right, so should I give extra credit for everything that comes in this week as opposed to next week? And get flooded this week as opposed to next? That would be a nice thing. Don't forget there's 10 points for being a responsible human being. And, you know, I've got one student that literally started passing things in this week. And, you know, those 10 points are not going to...
Sure.
So, anyway. Okay, the thing we have left to look at is triggers. And triggers are really neat. What triggers do is they are not attached to a program, per se. They're attached to a file or a table. So if you go in and make a change to that table that is talked about in the trigger, that is part of the trigger, then it will make the trigger act. So you can have a file out there and you want to know if anybody adds to that file or if anybody does anything to that file. A trigger will do that for you. So you can set up a trigger that basically says, anybody that touches this file, I'm going to go in and make a record of it or whatever. So you know about activity on the file. So those are kind of neat. I think I have them out here. So I'm going to bring up SQL Plus. Wait a minute, no, I don't want to bring that one up. I want to bring up PuTTY. Where do all your things get stored if you've got PuTTY? Where are the scripts you write stored? Has anybody found them, huh?
Yeah, in your window. WinSCP?
Yeah.
Right in the beginning.
Right. Has anybody seen those?
No, I haven't.
Okay. I thought of that the other night when I was doing this, that maybe I had never mentioned that. There's the SQL. Okay, if you go in to CIS Web, okay, so there's WinSCP. There they all are. So, you know, if you go in and you want to put something in, you go to public HTML. Well, if you don't go to public HTML, there's all your scripts sitting out there, okay?
My access denied, who I told you to log in, ethics.
You've got access denied on it?
Trying to log in.
The help desk. Okay. But, I mean, you can obviously get them just through PuTTY by, you know, doing a show. But if you want to see them, they're also shown out here. So, for example, we're going to look at this one called Array today. And there it is, sitting there. Okay, so I've got... If you log into WinSCP, there they sit. Now I can close that down. Okay, so what we've got with the triggers is I set up a table here, and this is where I'm going to put notes. So I set up this table, and I said change date and total amount. So I wanted to put in the total amount that was on this table, or some other thing. I could put a message, I could put a note, I could put everything. But date is usually an important thing to have. And I want to put it on there so that whenever the table is affected, I will make a note in this table. So I will make, you know, kind of a note about it. Okay. The name of the trigger I've got down here. So there's the trigger. And I can pick what I want it to react to. So I said create or replace trigger one. It's going to be run after an update on the new donation one. So if I do an update on new donation one, this will happen. This trigger will be executed. Okay? And somewhere in here, that went away. Up at the top, it tells you that you can say after insert or delete or update. You can pick one or more of them. You can have all three. So I can say I want any activity, basically, an insert, a delete, or an update. Or I can just say I want it for only this kind of activity. Okay, and like procedures and functions, once you have made the trigger, you have to do an @ trigger one to execute it. Okay, so that it's available. And if you don't do that, then the older version that you did do it on is going to be the one that's used. It's not going to update and use the newest version. Okay, so what I'm said here is if the trigger happens, and it's going to happen if I try to update, then what I'm going to do is select the sum of the con amount into this total, because I'm trying to keep it sum of the total, and then insert into total notes the date and the total amount. And I just put a fixed date in there, but I obviously could go get the date from the system. So I put in a date and the total amount, and that's the trigger then wrote that record onto the file called total notes. Okay? So I just use that. And then I have a program where I did the simple update. So I did this update, and whenever I do this update, the trigger gets called, because I said call the trigger when you do an update. So anytime I do the update, the trigger gets called. Okay? So I have that out there at some point. So if I run this program, which is called use trigger one, and we'll see if I have it out there, but I think I do. Okay, so enter the value for the ID number, and I'm going to use the numbers here because I don't remember all of the things, all of the numbers, so I'm going to use 33333 and drive number 300 and amount 35 or something. Okay, and it's been successfully completed. So now if I go and look at those notes, which was called what? Total notes. Okay. Okay, it went up 35. And I have that fixed date, so the date doesn't do you any good. But I added 35, and the last thing I had on here was 355, so now it's gone up 35, and it's got the 380. So if whenever any update happens on this table, I get a note about it. Okay, and I can have that doing updates, inserts, changes, whatever I want to have. But when I do it, it will write a note out there so that I keep a record of everybody hitting that table and making a change to that table. Okay, so that's what a trigger does. It is associated with the table and associated with the update, delete, or insert. And the rest of this handout is just my going in and doing other things to that table. Okay.
Question?
Yep.
So I'm trying to make sure I understand this. You have a main table there, and then there's triggers that are essentially in the same directory or something. How does Oracle know to go look for triggers, I guess?
Well, it's in the same saved area, and if not, you can put a path in if you have to do a path.
Okay.
You can put a path in.
And then it'll just look for everything that impacts that table, and then see
right.
If it's relevant to the
That's right.
Okay.
So anytime it is definitely associated with the table.
Yep.
And so you keep it where the tables are, I believe.
Okay.
I mean, where the files are, where
yep.
the tables, the databases.
This is an Oracle thing that it goes out all the time and looks for triggers.
That's right.
The table.
And it has that
any
something in its saving, and I don't know how it does that,
yeah.
but it saves it associated with that table. So if that table gets either changed or insert or delete, whatever it gets, it will then run that trigger. And it really is a security thing because it's keeping track of when anybody goes into this table, I'm going to know about it.
And it's keeping a log essentially.
And it's keeping a log. And you can decide what the log is going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a very simplistic log. But you can keep the log of what it is, and that will really, you know, it secures the table in the sense that you know it's been hit. And you have a record of it being hit.
You have user ID and stuff.
Oh, sure.
Whoever, yeah.
I mean, you could have a far more sophisticated thing, but it really lets you know when somebody's gone into that. Now, also, Oracle sets up security, so they will also, you can set up security so that tables are not supposed to be touched by, unless you have a certain security level. And we don't do that for obvious reasons, but I'm sure that we use Oracle as a school, and I'm sure they have it set up for there that, you know, you have to have a certain security clearance before you can get to some tables. You know, presumably I can't go in to a whole load of tables, but I can get in, and I can't even get in to change grades. I have to make a request. I can't go in and change a grade. I have to make a request to the administration to make the change to the grades and submit it because I don't have the security clearance to be able to go in and touch the files. Okay, more on triggers. This time I created a table called Column Stew. Okay, and if I look at that, okay, I put one person in there apparently when I was playing around with this last night. So I've got one person in there. So then I've got another table called Credit Range. Okay, so this says a freshman has 0 to 30, a sophomore has 31 to 60 credits. If you're a junior, you have 61 to 90. If you're a senior, you have 91 to whatever. And I set up that credit range table. Okay, so now I go down and I've got a program that I say insert into this table. Okay, so I can insert an ID, a name, number of credits, and a class level into the table. And again, that's the table that I did one insert on, and I've got Susan Ash in it. Okay, so I've decided that every time I want to do an insert, I want to know about it. So I'm going to set up a trigger tied to doing an insert. Okay. So this gets into a little more complicated trigger. I said create a replace trigger student log. Okay, so before insert on column stew, I'm doing this on a before. For each row, when new class level is not equal to senior. Okay, so I'm looking for, I'm not going to check up on senior, but I want to make sure the others are okay. And it says in here, select minimum credits, maximum credits into these fields from credit range where name equals colon new class. So this colon new here means, and it's explained down here, the use of old and new in the role level triggers. These define pseudo records that refer in the case of an update to the before and after. With insert old, you can't have old on an insert, and delete, you can't have new. Okay, so basically it can look at stuff and determine if there's going to be an error. This old or new is a pseudo record. And so it is kind of not doing an insert because I said I want a before insert. So I want to run this before I do the insert. So I'm basically checking to see if I want to do the insert. okay? So I am saying I want to do the insert where year name equals new class level. Okay, so I'm looking ahead and I'm raising an error if it doesn't work. Okay, so if I take this and I say, okay, I want to insert, and what is the name of that table? I got to go back. Use student trigger. Okay, so I'm inserting into use stu. No, that's not the name of the file. What's the name of the file? Okay, column stu. So insert into column stu, and I'm going to put in values, and I'm putting an ID number, so I'll make it 4567. I think it's a four character, if I remember correctly. And then the person's name. John Doe, the number of credits will be 75, and the class level is a freshman. Okay, and it gave me an error. The credits are out of range. Okay, so it gave me an error and it didn't do the insert. So if I go down here and do a select asterisk from column stu, Susan Ash is still the only one there. So it didn't do an insert because that didn't work. So now if I go back and try that insert again, insert into column stu, and it was four lines, so I will change that. Values 4567, John Doe, and keep the 75, but now say junior. Okay, it tells me that I can't.
John Doe,
right. Oh, wrong place. Okay. Hi. So now if I said it, I ran it, this one row was created. Okay, so that's been added. So it will add it if the new is working. So it goes in and checks, but it doesn't actually do the insert until it is verified that it is something that it wants to do via the trigger. Okay. So that is how you can set up a trigger. And again, at the end of this course, we're going into these things in PL/SQL just very briefly. If you ever get into Oracle, those are the kinds of things to really explore. Okay. So that is that. The other one that I had was an array. Somebody had asked about an array. So if I say edit array, okay, that brings up the array. And I can set up an array here where I'm saying type student array is varray 5. So I'm setting up an array of five elements. And then I said type grades is varray 5. And so I've got two tables that I'm setting up. Okay, each of them having five things. And then I came down here in the begin and I said Okay, I'm assigning Stu is going to be the individual name. Okay, and Stu is Stu Array, and these are all of the names that I'm putting into Stu Array, and then I do the same thing for grades. And then I set up and said, okay, Stu Count is going to be, go in and count how many students there are. And I could also do that for grade, but I didn't. Then I said, okay, so the total grade I'm going to set to zero, and I'm going to go into a loop where I accumulate the grades. So I'm going in here and saying grade modified by index. So it is stepping through each of the five grades, and I'm doing it up until Stu Count. For one, two, Stu Count is five, so from one to five. So I'm doing it for one to five. Okay? So that counts and gives me a total grade. Then I came down and I said, okay, the average is equal to the total grade divided by the Stu Count. And then I just put out the DBMS line that gave an output. And then I looped through and gave the information for each student. Okay? So I gave the total first, and that is using Stu Count and the average that I calculated. So I'm giving the total, and then I'm going through and listing each student in the array. So it's Stu modified by I and grade modified by I. So the way I do it is I define the array as a type. Then I come down and I assign the array content to a field. And that field is the name of each individual thing. So that's the name that's kind of repeated. You know how in most arrays you have a name that's repeated and then you show the index? Well, that's the name that's repeated. Stu modified by one, Stu, et cetera. Modified by him. And notice it starts with one as opposed to zero. Okay, and that's something you always need to check with arrays. Are they starting with one or are they starting with zero? So that's just a basic example of how an array works. Okay. And then if I leave this and go and exit that and run it, okay, there are my total, five, my average grade, and those are the lists of each individual student that I got when I ran through the list. Now, interestingly enough, when I was playing with this, I was having trouble with it working. And what I was getting is I wasn't getting the total. Okay, it wasn't giving me the total. And so I played around with it. And what I found was if I went back and set it to zero prior, it worked just fine. But if I didn't set it to zero, it didn't seem to have that initialized, even though I had set up at the top that, you know, this is an integer field, it just didn't work right. So I'm just kind of throwing that out there. As when something doesn't work, you obviously have to experiment. And initializing it made it work. But before I initialized it, I wasn't getting any total there. It wasn't giving me an error. It's just when I printed it out, it wasn't showing me the total.
I had a problem with something similar to that, but mine was, it was one off.
One off?
If I didn't set it to zero.
Okay.
I don't remember what assignment it was.
It started with one or something.
Yeah, and if I was trying to get it to work, and the calculation kept on being one off, it had one more than what it was supposed to be. For some reason, it stopped, but I didn't set it to one. I just declared it, but I didn't set it to anything.
Okay.
So for some reason, it automatically started as one, because finally I just went in and I set it to zero, and then it worked fine.
Okay.
So that's why I left. I can't remember what assignment it was.
Yeah, no, and I don't think I've run into that particular one, but as I said, I ran into something similar here. It wasn't giving me any answer. So the lesson here is that if it's not handling the field right, initialize it.
Yeah.
Because apparently there are places where it wants that to happen. You know, I don't think that that should have...
Well, I spent a good hour looking at the code trying to figure out where I messed up.
Right. No, I spent quite a lot of time on this, and then I said, all right, I want to see it, and I'm going to put in that and make sure that, and see it. That's interesting. That's why you get paid the big bucks, right? Okay, questions. Okay, the last thing I want to look at is Dave's favorite thing, apparently.
Check digits.
I asked you to do a check digit. Okay. So we're going to go through, this happens to be a Mod 11 check digit. What a check digit is you have an ID number and you want to validate that it's a valid ID number. So the last digit of that ID number is frequently, in a lot of situations, a check digit. And there are gazillion formulas that you can use to do check digit. Okay. So check digit is that you take the first, let's say, six characters of the ID, if it's a seven-character ID, you run a formula on it, and the answer should be the seventh character. And if it's not, then somebody put in an invalid ID. Okay, so a company will go and check when you have a transaction. They will check to see that it's a valid ID before they continue on. And the way they check it is some formula that usually comes up with the one-digit last number. Okay. So this one has, find the check digit for the number 036532. And this is called the Mod 11 check digit. And it is a reasonably straightforward one. So probably not as heavily used as the more sophisticated ones. Okay, so the first thing you do is you assign weights to each digit of the ID. So what that tells you is when I set this up, I have to have this as an array in the sense that I need access to every character. Okay, because I am going to go in and use individual characters. So I assign weights to each digit of the ID, okay? And for this particular one, I haven't got the check digit on this yet. This is the number prior to the check digit. So the weight is 2. When I have the check digit, the weight will be 1. The weight is 2 for the 2, 3 for the 3, 4 for the 5, and I keep going over and assigning my weights as I go along. Okay. Then each digit in the ID is multiplied by its weight. So you have a loop. And the loop is going through and multiplying each digit of the ID by its weight. So 7 times 0, 6 times 3 is 18, and all that good stuff. The next step is the result of the multiplication are added together. Okay, so I add up the result of the multiplication. So I've got a loop where I'm doing the multiply and then adding it to a total, adding the result to a total. So inside the loop, I'm doing the multiply and adding it to the total. Okay, so I'm getting a total of 81. Then I go in and I say, okay, take that total and divide it by 11. That's why it's called a Mod 11 check digit. And when you divide it by 11, you get 7 with a remainder of 4. Okay, so you want to get the remainder. And then you say, okay, 11 minus 4 equals 7. 7 is therefore the check digit. Okay, so those are the steps that you go through and 7 is therefore the check digit. Okay, when you go to check it, is the 7 added on? When you go to check it, you go through the same thing, only the 7 now has a weight of 1. You go through, you add them up, you divide by 11, and the remainder 0 means it worked. Okay? If the remainder is anything other than 0, it didn't work. Now, the problem with this one is if the remainder from the digit is 0 or 1, then subtraction will yield a two-digit number of either 10 or 11. Okay? That won't work. So if the check digit is 10, then X is frequently used as a check digit. And if the check digit is 11, then 0 is used. Okay, so that is the kind of aside that you have to put on this. And since I have the ability to have an X, then I have to have this as a non-numeric field, because an X can be added in. Okay. I don't think I've ever seen one with an X, so my suspicion is that those get thrown out and not assigned if they're going to have an X at the end. That wouldn't be assigned to someone, but I don't know that for sure. But okay. So, that's how you calculate the check. Okay. I'm done, but I've got somebody that just came in a few minutes ago that is going to talk to my 11th block class, and I'm going to get him to talk now. Okay. He is a graduate of the program, and he's going to basically tell you about what he does. So since I'm done and he's here, we're going to throw that in. Good.
Not Friday, not working.
So, introduce yourself and tell about yourself.
Sure. So, my name is Francisco Becker, and this is my second time coming back here. Right. I did this, we spoke to a few other classes last semester, and I graduated from Vista Community College about 5.5 years ago.
Time flies.
Yeah. With an associate's in computer programming, and I did fairly well while I was going to school. Professor Grosser, at the time, there were some companies looking for interns, and I was able to get an internship, and in East Providence, which was very convenient. I had another option too in Foxborough, but that was kind of far away from me at the time. I joined that. I did that internship for about eight months or so, and it eventually started getting a little too easy for me, so then I moved on to a bigger development role with more responsibilities and more, you know, it was a little bit more complicated.
What were you writing in originally? And
so when I was there, it was a mixture of things, but it was mostly, I set up their marketing websites for, it was like a company, an umbrella company with 4 other companies underneath it, and they just needed someone to come in and build like WordPress websites and things like that. And then I ended up doing a lot of like responsive web design work because they needed the websites to obviously work across all sorts of different devices. So that was pretty cool. I learned a lot there. But then I moved on to my other role was kind of cool too because I worked at a design agency. So I did a lot of like cool interactive web work, and that took a lot of, that was heavily done with jQuery and then eventually very object-oriented JavaScript. So I work mostly in the web application space. But now I'm after a few other roles, now I work. I'm a senior software engineer at Fidelity Investments, and still working on web applications, but I do a lot of internal application work, so I work across the entire stack from database to server to the web browser. And as I said, from time to time, I also still do some responsive design work, which I think it's cool, but it's been a while since I've done that, because when you work in the web application world, as you start getting more experience, you start doing more and more back-end work than front-end work, but it's just as complicated. But it's, you know, it's just the nature of the beast, because as you start getting more experienced, then they start to entrust you with the servers, because it's easy to make mistakes in the web browser, but you can't make mistakes in the back-end, because you make mistakes, you know, in the server, you could run into a lot of data problems, data issues, so. But that's where I'm at now. I do mostly JavaScript, full-stack JavaScript, so Node, Angular. Now I'm starting getting to TypeScript, and when it comes to the backend, MySQL, Oracle, MongoDB, and a lot of getting into different servers. So right now I'm working on a script to archive a bunch of content on a Windows server, and so I'm kind of going using PowerShell and writing a bunch of different batch scripts to do all of that. And then I have to do the same for Linux servers. Not, you know, not the same problem, but I have to do a lot of batch scripting on Linux servers as well. I have to get into the terminal and do all that crazy stuff, you know. So it's pretty cool. I like it. You guys have any questions?
Oh, come on, somebody.
That was just super high level. You know, I don't want to bore you with all the details.
So, I mean, I have a lot of opportunity to, I mean, with Fidelity, they probably have a pretty good training program. How did you pick up the skills that were beyond what you got initially at school?
So the way I look at it is, I kind of always try to get to a job where I want to learn that skill set. So when I joined Fidelity, there was an opening for a full-stack JavaScript guy. So they needed a lot of Node.js work. And at that time, I was good, but I could, you know, I wanted to get better. So then that's when I kind of took on that role. Because all you have to do is go in and do the interview. And, you know, if they like you, they think, they're never going to think you know everything. You know, they just want to see, just want to make sure that you're good enough where they can trust you with some of the work. And then they can just kind of look over your shoulder if they have. And then that's pretty much how I've been there now for 3 years. So I'm at a level now where I can go in and look over, you know. So they kind of, that's usually how it works. They just want to, they don't want you to know everything, but they want to make sure that you're like in the right track and like, potentially pick that up fairly quickly. You know, you come from a similar background that could eventually fit into that.
So do they send you out for classes, or do they expect you'll learn it on your own from trial and error?
So there's a lot of that, learning on your own. So they just kind of, you know, they give you time to figure it out. I learn into, I build internal applications, so I run into a lot of unique problems that I kind of have to figure it out on my own. And then once it comes to things, here's where they kind of invest they kind of give you some training is when they try to go somewhere with the tech stack. So they're trying to incorporate some sort of new technology, and then that's when they'll have people come in and maybe train us or have us go out to different conventions and stuff. But we also we do a lot of they give us accounts to Udemy.com, and I find that very helpful. I don't know if you know, Udemy, I think it's very cool.
Okay.
it's very, so I'm still taking a course there on Angular 2.0, and it's like 40 hours long. You think, oh, 40 hours, it's not, but it takes a while to like digest all of that. And then now they want me to learn like AWS, so now I'm going to have to, Udemy also provides a class on that subject, so I'm going to take that one as well. But it's, again, it's like 40 hours, and that takes some time. That takes at least like a month or two to digest.
And then if you have problems, is there people that are willing to help you?
Yeah. There's always, it's mostly like I'm able to figure out most of the stuff on my own. But whenever we have huge issues that pertain to like important subjects, important data, then we kind of all get together in a room and then we whiteboard things out. And then we do that eventually once every week or once every 2 weeks until we have like a good working prototype, and then we test it, and then we eventually release it. But again, even though a lot of the other team members are not having me involved, they still know what's going on, and they can still share ideas and point you in the right direction.
Okay. And you haven't gone on from your associates, right?
No, I'm still.
So, you know, just an example of a job that you can get with just an associate.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, it's as I said here before, it's very experience-based, you know. You could have you could have a master's, you could have a PhD in computer science. You're going to come in, you're going to have to pick up the language just like everybody else, you know. You're going to have to learn how to get into servers and how to use an operating system through the terminal, you know. And just like anybody else, like everybody has to go through that. And a lot of that stuff they just don't teach in school, you know. So now, especially nowadays, whenever you're coding something, you're always using some sort of framework. And they also don't really teach any of that stuff in school. They teach, you know, the basics. And I think one thing that I'll probably go back to school for is just a high-level math, but I don't see myself going back to learn more programming. You know, I got enough programming to deal with this. and then, as I said, you usually pick up frameworks, but you
like, what frameworks do you use?
Like Angular. So in the back end, I use Node.js, I use Express, which is, it's fairly simple, it's very straightforward. But then Node is always synchronous, so it can get kind of complicated, you know. Then I use another library called Async, just to manage the flow control, because you need to manage all the different callbacks, because it's, again, it's always synchronous, right?
Can you explain to the class what a framework is?
Yeah, sure. So a framework is like, it's not a library per se, but it's
okay, back row.
It's kind of, how can I explain this? Especially in the programming world, it's kind of like a suite of things that allow you to program in an object-oriented way, but with some sort of with rules and guardrails, so that once people can come in and out of your code base, and if they are familiar with the framework, they can easily pick up and add or, you know, update, maintain the code easily and more freely than if they were doing it without any sort of framework or just, you know, free coding. So it's just easier. Like people, because the frameworks will provide you with a lot of tool sets, a lot of different functionality that you don't have to build on your own, because it's already part of the framework. And then they also have a team who usually maintains and upgrades the framework. So that's another thing you don't have to worry about, because then they're constantly maintaining and updating the framework for you. and all you have to do is then, within your own code bases, just upgrade to the newest version of that framework. So it's basically writing software with software that allows you to, which gives you a more capabilities and more tooling and things of that nature. Things that you won't have to write yourself, basically. Because if you have to do everything on your own, then you won't be there for a while. So I always encourage people to use different frameworks, but you want to use also, what's the most popular and what will have the longest longevity. Because like when I started, I did a lot of Backbone, which was a JavaScript framework. And unfortunately, now it's not as popular. Angular is rightfully so the most popular JavaScript framework, and it's also maintained by Google. So whenever you work with a big business or corporation, they tend to use frameworks or software that are written by other corporations because they know they can trust that that will be properly maintained. So that's why a lot of big companies use IBM and Oracle, because they know, that's in the business of that, and they can be held accountable whenever something fails. They can come in and work on it and fix it for you. So yeah, so that's pretty much what the framework is.
Yeah, go and look up Angular sometime when you have a few spare moments.
Yeah, Angular 2 is pretty cool. Okay. It's kind of complicated.
I haven't looked at that. I've looked at Angular.
Yeah, Angular 2 is heavily TypeScript based. So, and then they kind of get you to write TypeScript. So TypeScript's like a subset of JavaScript. It's like the futuristic JavaScript. So they're ahead of what JavaScript will be in maybe a decade or two. And then Angular is purely written in TypeScript. So even when you look, Angular 2, so even when you look at examples, it's all in TypeScript. And that's where things are heading now.
Do you feel like not having a bachelor's is held you back at all? Do you think that it's held you back from commanding a certain salary or getting any type of job?
No, not really. I never had that feeling, to be quite honest. And my director at the time, he's not my director anymore, but he's one of the most knowledgeable professors I've ever seen. He only has a high school diploma. I don't know how big of an impact that would be maybe in the future as I move on, move up the corporate ladder, but I still don't think that's really an issue. Because they look at you for who you are, you know what I mean? They look at you for the kind of work that you do, they judge you based on your performance. So if you're there for a few years, they're not going to be like, oh, I can't, promote you because you don't have the degree. It's just, unless you're a doctor of interest, then obviously, or an accountant, But I think for 80% of the jobs out there in the tech field, a degree should not be a problem. They're gonna come in, they're gonna look at your resume and your past experience, and they'll be able to judge you. They'll be able to judge how good you are. Because let's say if I had a master's degree in computer science, right? And then a few years go by, and then I try to apply to work at Google, my advantages as a master's degree holder from a guy who has an associate's degree, after a few years out of college, it's not going to be a huge difference, because you're going to forget a lot of that stuff that you went to school for, It's very true. If you don't use it, you lose it. You do a bunch of math, when you start programming, you're not doing a lot of that math. You might be doing it if you're working on algorithms all day. And then that's when the degree does apply. If you're dealing with heavy algorithms and heavy math, then you're going to be. But when you're writing code, it's just getting a big problem down into smaller problems, you know? You're not doing calculus all day, which some people do think that's what happens, but it's just logic, you know? So it all depends. If you want to hide, if you want to write, like, algorithms, then yeah, you're going to need like, that sort of
And that's lots of times in the area of developing operating systems or developing
that
kind of stuff.
So when I used to work at the startup and we had like a mobile app, an Android app, and it needed like a high-level algorithm. So at that time we would write all the code around the algorithm, and there was a particular person just working on the algorithm, and he was an electrical engineer who also would eventually picked up, learned how to code, but it was a very high-level algorithm that needed someone with, like, an engineering license, you know, and then, but then that requires a lot of math work, you know? So it all depends on what, if you need that high-level math, then yeah, I'll go and get my bachelor's, but if you just want to code, you don't really need that much math. It's always helpful, don't get me wrong.
And some companies do have a glass ceiling when you go, as you said, when you move up the chain. Some companies do have a glass ceiling that at a certain point they want a bachelor's.
Yeah.
So it's always nice if you have the chance to pick it up one course at a time or two courses at a time, and then by the time you hit the glass ceiling, you'll have the bachelor's.
Yeah, that's true. If you want to do it, I mean, you can do it slowly. You can finish your associates in 2 or 3 years, and then in 10 years finish your bachelor's. You know, I don't see how that would be so difficult. I even thought about doing that, but I have to learn so much on my own just to stay up to date with all the technology changes that I don't really see myself doing that. I might go back and do some more high-level math, but I think that's about it. But I don't want to discourage you, you know. You feel like you can go and get your bachelor's and go right ahead. At that time, I was even thinking about it, but then, you know, life just took over. I got one job, another job, and now I am where I'm at. So.
What is the salary range that you see in the jobs you've had in the company, not what your salary is, but the salary range?
I think for my experience in Boston, I mean, it all depends on your performance as well. Because a lot of people, some people have careers and some people have jobs, you know, so it all depends what you want to do. I've met many people who have a master's degree and they come in at 9 and live at 3:30. Not that there's anything wrong with that, it's just, you know, like some people think degrees are all that. You got your degree, you can work anywhere. But, so I think it all depends. I look at it as a level of experience. So from 0 experience to 2 years of experience, your salary could double. So meaning like you're probably going to start off, it all depends on the area, but if you start off in Boston, you're probably going to, so it won't double, but you're probably going to start off at 60,000 or so. And then if you have 2 years of experience, you could easily jump from 80 to 90. And then on a 5-year range, then you're looking at 100 grand or over, you know, 100. That's just base salary. And there's like, there's bonus, there's 401k, there's profit sharing, if you're a full-timer. So yeah, I mean, yeah, 5 years in, you're definitely like good, like low 6 figures with everything, maybe like in between 100 and 120. That's like 5 years in, which is a good salary, you know?
That's lovable.
I mean, unfortunately, the day and age we live in right now is kind of tough, but especially like, because I live over there in the Boston area, and the real estate is expensive, so even though you make good salaries, it's kind of like, it's okay, but it's not, you know, when you try to own a house or something, then you gotta make a little bit more. Or you gotta get married and hopefully your significant other makes as much as you do. So. Oh, but yeah, if you like having, it's definitely like a good career where you're gonna have a good job and make good money and have great benefits and be comfortable off, you know, without owning your own business, let's say, or without being like a dentist or a doctor. Those guys make a lot more, but I think as a software engineer or anyone, you know, a good computer career will get you a good salary. But again, it's all based on experience. The diploma will get you through the door, and then eventually you build yourself up. Because as you talk to recruiters, you're going to get on the phone with recruiters, they're going to ask, oh, I'm, okay, you graduated, okay, great, how many years of experience do you have? You know, that's what they want to see, they want to, and that's how they can gauge your salary.
So co-op is something to definitely consider, talking to the people in co-op about getting an internship.
Yeah, I think
in the Fall River area, salaries are going to be lower, but they also is probably easier to get in with an entry-level position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Yeah, I remember when I graduated, there was plenty of potential employers looking for.
Right.
So, yeah, you just got to, especially when you're young, you know, that's the best time to do it. When I did it, I was young, I barely had any responsibilities, so to me it was very easy to commit to any sort of role. But I think it's definitely very important, especially when you're still young. And and then as I said, that would just add on to your resume and, you know, your profile.
Thank you. Anybody's got any other questions? Okay.
All right. Thank you.
And I'm done too, so we're all done. Yeah.
She never did that.
Actually, there was an email today to my boss asking for his report.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know where that is, so I thought I would talk in the
conference.
But she apparently was up because she did cost us a lot of money. But I noticed this morning, and I'm looking at a checking note, and I already did, and saw that we had been working on the floor, and I think that it's been progress, but we'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
So you focus on the other side.